www.wpfwinc.org/DC917. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
At 89.3 FM, this is member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, September 16th. I'm Gina Parker, and we're so glad to be joined today. Later in the show, we'll speak with Washington Theater Amy Austin about DC's Theater Week, which begins this Thursday. Did you know that DC has the second largest theatrical community in the country? And we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the show. But first, we have to talk about the current issue, the current political climate that's going on right now. The norm for American presidents, when something like the murder of an important political figure takes place, is to take the quote unquote high road and to cool down the discourse with a unifying message. There have been a lot of examples of this, including the response of President Trump back in 2017 to the attack by a Bernie Sanders supporter on Steve Scalise and other Republicans at a congressional baseball practice. But now it seems like the message has been diverting, in that the death and murder of Charlie Kirk has been perceived as an attack from Trump's enemies. There have been statements about a bunch of radical lunatic leftists that include Democrats and nonprofits and philanthropists like George Soros. That was said even before the suspect was confirmed to being from not a leftist family or a leftist political leaning, but that of a right constituency. As Trump said, the enemy within the country is more dangerous than the foreign adversary like Russia or China. And it's tried and true, the playbook of authoritarianism. But joining us today to talk about all of this is Ed Lazier, the founder of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute and the current director of legislative advocacy of the United Planning Organization, and Cole Lightyear, the executive director of Americans Against Government Censorship, which honestly, I want to jump right into this because we have seen the language and messaging around censorship grow tremendously. Grow tremendously in context to one's feelings about what happened to Charlie Kirk. So welcome, and listeners, we're very interested in hearing from you. Please call us at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. So let's go ahead and jump right in. I'd love to hear from our guests to give a brief introduction and then just going right into the topic around what's happening in this moment. Cole, Ed, are you guys there?
We are, yeah. Jenna. Thank you so much for having us on today.
Yeah, go for it, Cole. I just wait and see who you wanted to call on first, but I think it'd be great to hear from Cole first. For it.
Sure.
Well, Jenna, as you shared with your listeners, my name is Cole Leiter. I'm the executive director of an organization called Americans Against Government Censorship. We work across the ideological spectrum, organizing nonprofits to ensure that lawmakers and leaders in this country are hearing and understand the threats that this administration poses to free speech, to advocacy work, to those who want to hold the government accountable. And what sounded like theoretical warnings about government weaponization have become a reality for Americans across the country. Native Washingtonians saw it over the last month. Americans living in Los Angeles have seen it as well. And while the administration and other political actors have been laying the groundwork for this moment over the past 8 months of this administration, we've seen a significant and frankly dangerous shift in tone and intent from the highest levels of the White House since Charlie Kirk's horrific assassination. And I think we need to pause there for a moment and say very clearly, political violence of any kind is unacceptable in this country, whether it is the targeted attack of Minnesota State Speaker Melissa Hortman and her family, whether it is drive-by shootings in New Mexico against elected representatives, or whether it's Charlie Kirk's assassination, no political violence is acceptable. And frankly, other than the attempts by the administration to weaponize this moment to attack their political opponents, it has been heartening to see leaders from across the ideological spectrum, including Senator James Lankford, who stepped into the breach yesterday and made very clear that we should not be seizing this moment to attack political opponents. We should also be clear that this tragedy is being manipulated. No evidence has been produced, and the president, the vice president, high-ranking leaders inside the cabinet, inside the White House, are using this moment to target their political opponents and portray them as enemies. I want to make time for the other folks who are joining today to lay out their perspective, but it is critical that we view this moment as serious. This is not something that happens in a high-functioning democracy, where constitutionally protected rights are protected and upheld. And it is on all of us, citizens, elected officials, people of conscience across the country, to stand up and stand with people who are being targeted in this moment for no reason and without evidence. Look forward to the conversation and hearing the questions coming in from listeners.
Yeah, that was, thank you, Cole. That was a great introduction, Parker. You know, I'm on today, I think, as someone who has spent a long time in the world specifically of local DC politics and policy. And so I will sort of focus a lot of my comments there, but just, you know, broadly, it to reinforce what Cole said, it definitely feels the moment we're in is just a continuation of the Trump administration's bid to just increase its power at all costs, to achieve its political agenda at all costs, and to ignore the law or certainly bend the law as much as possible. So the thing that comes to mind for me is the decision the Trump administration made in early August to invoke part of the Home Rule Act that allows the president under emergency to basically employ the MPD to serve federal purposes. You know, and he claims it's about crime when, of course, it's just about power and power over Democratic cities, in this case, the District of Columbia. There was not a crime emergency. There still is not a crime emergency. And if there were a crime emergency, the federal government could find many, many cooperative ways to work with the District of Columbia to try, or other cities or rural areas, to try to reduce crime, not come in and use this heavy-handed approach. And of course, as many of your listeners know, what this has turned out to be was not so much an effort to reduce crime in the District of Columbia, but really a way to bring ICE into the city full force. And it really just was part of the president's deportation agenda. It seems to be, you know, why we're seeing so many helicopters on the road and so many black unmarked cars on the street and masked ICE agents and others. And so I certainly agree with Cole that this is a super scary moment. And I just want to make sure that we're peeling back any of the arguments, BS arguments, that the administration is making about why they're doing any of these things, and just to focus on how much this is all about building their power as much as possible, and building their and achieving their political goals as much as possible, and ignoring whatever democratic constraints there are, which is, yes, why we should be super scared and engaged, whether we're in the District of Columbia or any other place in the country.
I think both of you brought up very good points in context to how the assassination of Charlie Kirk is being used to be the talking point to strip like democratic rights and rule on a state, local, and national level, as well as target who Trump feels like are his political opponents. opponents in a way that, to your point, bends the law. And we talk about the person who was assassinated. He was a successful conservative organizer for young voters. He organized and he created a turning point when as an 18-year-old, and he had a podcast with enormous following. But for those who are not familiar with some of Kirk's positions, they were pretty extreme in context to he thought the Civil Rights Act was a mistake. He repeatedly said that Martin Luther King Jr. should not have a holiday. And his thoughts on gun control was that he thought it was worth gun deaths every year so that we could have the Second Amendment to protect our God-given gun rights. And it's very interesting how a lot of these are his own views from his own mouth, his own words. And a lot of pushback has been given by the right-wing community or the conservative community when in his assassination, and these are posted in context to how people viewed this situation in general. It's being said that this is insensitive, or this is inappropriate, or that this is not, you know, unifying the message. Can you guys talk about how there are these two different thought processes in the way that the community at large is viewing the assassination of Charlie Kirk and how it's being used to target nonprofits and nonprofit organizations, particularly ones that are democratic? We can start with you, Ed.
Sure, happy to go. Again, you know, for me, it is just peeling it back. Like, it feels like any moment is being used as an excuse to go on the attack. And in the district, the thing that led the president to take over MPD was an attack on one of the Doge staffers that happened in the district. I believe it was a carjacking, but media, you know, investigation has shown that they were working on that plan for months and they were just looking for the moment. And I think as genuine as their grief is over the assassination of Charlie Kirk, which is a shock, despite how vile he was as a person and his politics, that their grief is genuine, but their opportunism is also really transparent. And, you know, the thing that comes to mind to me most immediately is this 18-year-old in Texas who did something that probably was not like what we would consider the most appropriate of going to a Charlie Kirk vigil and gloating over his death. But we have a First Amendment in this country that allows people to say obnoxious things as long as it doesn't cross the line into threats or actual threats or actual physical violence. And yet she was arrested for assault. I don't know the full details of what this person did and whether it meets the standard of assault or not, but it sounds like they were just being loud and obnoxious, and got kicked out of their school. And again, it's just any excuse that they have to attack institutions that are challenging their authority. So I'll let Cole speak to the attacks on the nonprofits, which I know is also happening. But for me, that First Amendment attack is the one that is just sticking with me right now. And I hope somebody stands up to defend that person. I haven't seen yet any news reports of whether the ACLU or others are coming out to that person's defense, but they should.
I want to definitely go to Cole, but I did want to give additional context to something that you said. Further reports and investigations have bore out that what was happening was, unfortunately, a woman was being harassed or assaulted by the young man that was attacked, that was the staffer for Doge, and that those two gentlemen that were arrested for the attack and accused of being the carjackers were actually interceding to stop the harassment that they perceived was happening from that particular Doge official to the woman. Again, these are still reports that are coming out as the investigation is ongoing. But I did want to cite that it seems like there's a lot of like initial information put out about an incident. And then as more information comes out, you find that it's not what you think it is. During the assassination part of Charlie Kirk, it was put out that this person was connected to left wings and all these other radicalized movements. But as we get more information, we understand that he was raised a far right conservative. And there's even discussions about how, unfortunately, the thought process behind this was that Charlie Kirk wasn't radical enough. But Cole, I want to get to you in context to how this moment is being used to not really honor the grief that people have, but to go after the nonprofits and other Democratic parties. And if you have something to say about this issue, please call us at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Cole.
Ed laid this out perfectly. It is a fundamental right in the United States of America that speech is protected, whether that is speech based in hate, speech based in controversial ideas, or speech based in love and in the mainstream. That is something that makes our country unique, certainly from Europe, where hate speech is criminalized in a lot of countries. And so the fact that Charlie Kirk said things that a lot of people in this country, frankly, made a career out of saying a lot of things, and that things that a lot of people in this country disagreed with vehemently, is protected by our laws and is critical to the fabric of a thriving and liberal democracy that we have benefited for coming up soon 250 years. And the fact that the Department of Justice yesterday went on TV to say that they are going to investigate people for hate speech is dangerous. Now, people should understand that the things that they say in public or when they're representing their employer, they may be held responsible for. That is a part of being in a marketplace of free ideas. It is that you have the right to say things, and you also will be held responsible for the things that you say. I also want to underline that there is a clear difference between hate speech and political violence, and where we are targeting people with the intent to hurt them, to kill them, and otherwise, that clearly crosses a line that is unacceptable and has been widely, widely criticized by leaders on both sides of the ideological spectrum. And like we've talked about, the administration, which has been looking for an excuse to grow the power of the government, abuse the power of the government to target their ideological opponents, has clearly, before a shred of evidence has been produced, tying the killer, the accused killer, to any ideological movement or to any organization, has used this moment to go after nonprofits and say very clearly that they are going to dismantle any organization that opposes the administration, is dangerous. And it is critical that nonprofits, whether they are local service providing organizations or regional or national advocacy organizations, stand up and say very clearly that these kinds of attacks on people who are just trying to help their communities are unacceptable in this country. And are an attack on a free society by a government that is recklessly out of control, trying to find new ways to use the great weight of the federal government to target its ideological opponents.
And it's really interesting that you bring that up, because I've been in so many spaces and where essentially people are like, it's almost like upside down or bizarro world, where up is down and down is up and right is left and left is right. And they're talking about that from the perspective of, people said that they wanted to shrink the government, but they've only cut jobs, but expanded the government's reach in like very personal or private matters in a different capacity. And it's all falling under this thought of an ideological principle that honestly runs directly counter to the democratic way that America, like we said, was for 250 years. And I appreciate you clarifying the difference between hate speech and political violence, and how those things are interconnected, but they're also separate, and how us as a community really need to focus on that in relation to us moving forward. And then talking about the protected rights of free speech, it is very concerning to hear that the Department of Justice is essentially investigating people for hate speech in context to their views on the assassination of Charlie Kirk, but not actually investigating hate speech that targets people of color, Democratic opponents, nonprofits that all focus on helping their communities. It's a very telling situation when that is the case. I just wanted to talk about, like, just also the attack on about every institution in the country, universities, law firms, museums, various government agencies, and how that ties into the expansion of limiting our rights. If you could talk, Ed, about how that looks in DC. I know you touched on it a little bit before when you talked about how the Home Rule Act was enacted, but can you talk about how this affects, you know, the universities of DC, the law firms, and even the museums, and how that affects, like, the quality of life?
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously part of their power building and ideological control to try to tell museums what exhibits they can have, to try to tell universities what they could talk about, to tell law firms who they can work for. All of those are, you know, an affront to a democracy where people have the ability, you know, the right to speak their minds and associate and engage in business with people that they want to. You know, when I think about the District of Columbia, I would shift my answer a little bit, because I think one of the current issues right now, again, related to trying to control our institutions, local police agencies across the country are often reluctant to get involved in immigration enforcement, which is a federal responsibility. And the reason for the reluctance isn't because of a position one way or the other on what federal law on immigration is, but that as a matter of creating local public safety officials need to be able to engage with the community in a trustworthy way. So whether a person in the community thinks that you're going to sick child welfare on them if you come and investigate, or sick in ICE on them if you come to investigate a crime, people are going to be reluctant to engage with local police officials. And that is why in the District of Columbia, we say and have laws that limit the role of our police department, MPD, in immigration enforcement, and why Mayor Bowser rightly said after the emergency control of our police department ended that the city would no longer actively engage and participate with the federal government in immigration enforcement. At least that seems to be the direction that Mayor Bowser is going, and I encourage her to be very explicit and clear that that is the way she's going, so that everybody in the district understands that we control our institutions and we keep us safe. And the best way to keep us safe is for us to follow our own rules and not have the federal government take over our institutions and tell us what to do.
Jana, I served in federal government at the United States Department of Transportation and had the opportunity to go into work every day and do something to improve the lives of people in local communities who wanted better roads, safer bridges, a commute that actually got them to work on time and home to their families quickly. That is how government should work. Government is not a tool for the people in it to exercise their petty grievances against their ideological or personal opponents. And that's how it's being used. It's being used right now to target churches that are doing local service providing work. It's being used right now to handicap the ability of organizations, frankly, that are working on government contracts to provide services that the government is not well situated to provide, from fulfilling their mission, just because those contracts were made under a previous administration. It's being used to target law firms because there are people inside that firm who may have served in a previous administration. That is not what the American people expect from their government. And frankly, we have a long history of fearing an out-of-control centralized government that can be weaponized against everyday people. And that's what we're seeing right now.
That's a very good point. I want to make sure I reach out to my listeners. You can call us at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. And I'm being joined by Ed Lazar. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Ed Lazire?
It's Lazier. There you go.
Lazier. Okay. Yeah. Ed Lazier.
A lot of people get it wrong. Yeah.
Thank you. Ed Lazier, founder of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute and the current director of the legislative advocacy at the United Planning Organization, and Cole Lightyear, executive director of Americans Against Government Censorship. I thought what you brought up, Cole, was very on spot on in context to what we have been told for the onset of America, what we're trying to avoid, what apparently America was started for in regards to stopping governmental overreach versus what is actually happening now in the governmental overreach and the taking of rights. And so I also wanted to go into any thoughts on how all of this diverts attention to what was unifying the country in context to the push against people losing their benefits from Medicare and SNAP, people really wanting to know what was going on with the Epstein files and things that were happening that was really uniting people on the right and left. Any thoughts of how this assassination is being used in regards to that level of divisiveness? And we can start with Cole.
I won't speak to the direct motivations of this administration. I think I'll let them speak to their motivations. One thing is clear, though. This administration has chosen, frankly, a corrupt bargain. They are cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans at the same time that millions of Americans are going to see their health care become more expensive. They came into office claiming that they were going to bring prices down, but we haven't seen that. And at the same time, we're seeing top administration officials launch cryptocurrencies that they're pocketing billions of dollars from and use their positions to enrich themselves. That's concerning for everyone because Americans are working really hard to make ends meet right now. And I think a lot of people are wondering when the government is going to take a look at the economic situation and say, hey, we've got to do something. And right now, we've seen the government step away from the everyday economic needs of most Americans and take a hard look at how they can weaponize the government to punish their ideological opponents. That is using power in all the wrong ways, and is frankly concerning from a policy perspective and where the rubber meets the road for the concerns of people who are trying to do their jobs and raise their families. So I would encourage people inside of government to focus their energy on bringing prices down for Americans, focus their energy on not seeing huge spikes or not creating huge spikes in the cost of healthcare for folks who are counting on their healthcare to be affordable. Make those priorities, not finding new ways to turn the government into a weapon against their political opponents.
You know, I would focus my response on the effort of not just the assassination of Charlie Kirk and the response, but what was already underway, which was the plan of the Trump administration to send the military into as many cities as possible, targeting Democratic-led cities under the supposed claim that crime is a problem when, you know, as I noted earlier, if they really cared about crime in the country, they would have a much more collaborative planning approach with jurisdictions across the country in cities and smaller communities as well. And this is just clearly part of their effort to intimidate Americans and build their power that way, their autocratic power, but also clearly just a political narrative that, oh, any place run by Democrats is horrible and is overrun by crime, and they're, you know, only we can save it. It's clearly a distraction from an economy that is tanking, that is, you know, people are very nervous about every day. There's more and more news reports of unemployment rising, long-term unemployment rising, prices rising, people being scared. And that hasn't, we haven't even had a single person cut off SNAP or Medicaid yet. And they know those are unpopular. And we know the president is barely talking about all of those things and shifting, trying to shift the conversation to avoid it. And, you know, you just look at the propaganda as well, again, focusing here on the district where he brought in the National Guard. Mostly they just put mulch around trees and picked up trash because they didn't want to be involved and are not allowed to be involved in local law enforcement. And yet now that the control of our police department is over that 30-day period that the home rule law allows, he was like, oh, crime is gone in the District of Columbia, as if a 30-day presence of any police force would eliminate crime in the district. It is completely propaganda. It was propaganda to come into the city or any other city across the country. And it's now propaganda that it's over, claiming this victory. Just all part, again, of a distraction from the truth, whether it's to build their political power or to avoid, you know, damaging losses in the 2026 elections.
Jana, can I bring one thing back to this core moment that we are in? At the end of this month, the government is going to shut down unless Congress is able to pass a budget. And right now, Speaker Johnson and Leader Thune in the House and in the Senate on the Republican side are refusing to put forward a budget that reverses devastating Medicaid cuts. They're refusing to put forward a budget that prevents healthcare costs from going up. They're refusing to put forward a budget that blocks huge tax breaks for the rich and big corporations. And they're trying to point the finger at other folks. We've seen from the very clear call from the American people in August when lawmakers were back home, that those are their priorities. And it is important that leaders in Washington hear them and make those priorities what's on the table in the negotiation around how we are going to keep the government open. And that is a question of whether leaders on both sides are going to hear that call and make those the priorities. We've started to see Leader Jeffries and Schumer on the Democratic side make those the priorities. And that's an incredibly important first move. And I hope that we see that same focus on kitchen table economics from leaders on the Republican side of the aisle. And I think if they listen to that, then there's the potential for a good budget deal. But if they don't hear that call, that puts us in a place where a government shutdown becomes much more likely.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. I just want to make sure the listeners know to call in. We have just a few more minutes with our wonderful guest, Ed Lazier, founder of DC Fiscal Policy Institute and the current director of legislative advocacy at the United Planning Organization, and Cole Lightyear, executive director of Americans Against Government Censorship. And I just want to say that you can call in at 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Kind of some of our other questions that I definitely wanted to get to. Do you guys feel like your organizations could be targeted too? And are you afraid of Trump going after nonprofit tax statuses in that capacity?
I'll start here, and then Ed would love you to jump in as well. we have seen that this administration is trying to give the Treasury Secretary enormous power to weaponize the IRS against nonprofits that are ideologically different from this administration. From the very beginning, there was actually a bill in the last Congress that would have increased those powers. They tried to put that same provision into a must-pass piece of legislation this summer. And we expect that Secretary Bessent is going to target nonprofits and try to strip away their tax status because it's what they've said that they want to do, both in communications from the administration in writing and what they're saying on TV. So, I think that people should expect that the government is going to try to attack the ability of organizations, whether they're national advocacy organizations or local service providing organizations like food banks or homeless shelters or churches, frankly, that differ from the ideological position of this administration, that they will target them using the IRS. They will target them using the Department of Justice and all of its different arms and try to dismantle them, as Vice President Vance said yesterday when he was hosting Charlie Kirk's show. So this is a very concerning moment for folks in the civic space who are trying to protect their communities, serve their communities, and make sure that people have access to food, water, shelter, a good paying job, and affordable health care. And it is deeply troubling is a weak word. It is really, really sad and scary that this is how our government is being used against the American people.
Okay, I'm going to let Ed go, and then I'm going to take the caller.
Yeah. So, Parker, you know, I should say I am currently the legislative advocacy director at United Planning Organization. That's my job. I'm really here today not expressing opinions on behalf of the organization, but more myself. But I will say we are United Planning Organization is a multi-service organization that is trying to improve economic security and reduce poverty in the District of Columbia. And that means things like providing early head start to 700 children. It means providing job training, housing assistance to people who have experienced homelessness and many, many other things. And we are deeply worried, right? The Trump administration has already signaled they don't like head start or early head start. They've already tried to limit access to immigrants, even though head start does not by law allow people to ask recipients of their immigration status. We are also recipient of a War on Poverty era block grant that is intended to bring direct anti-poverty funds into communities rather than through state bureaucracies, the community service block grant. And that is also under attack. So we very much are worried that there are just attack on services that support people with low incomes under attack, not specifically as an organization that's being targeted for, you know, to have our 501c3 status removed, but just simply dismantling of things that help people across the country. And, you know, the program that they're going after, the community service block grant, just like public radio, much of the benefit is in small rural communities where there just isn't an infrastructure otherwise. And the federal funding allows anti-poverty resources to flow directly into those communities. So it would be damaging a lot of Trump voters in addition to harming us here in the District of Columbia.
Thank you so much. All right, caller, please tell us your name, where you're from, and your question for our guest.
Yeah, my name is T. Berry, and I'm calling from Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I wanted to ask your guest, because you started out talking about speech, hate speech and whatever, and I think that...
You're breaking up a little bit.
I'm sorry, I'm breaking up.
You're breaking up a little bit, caller?
I'm sorry to hear that. Can you understand me at all? I wanted to ask about the free speech and issue that you started out talking about in the United States. Okay, excellent.
Sure, what's your question?
You know, in the United States, you could not keep your job and use the word genocide in the big public media. You could not, if you were Arab, keep your job. You could not get publicized. And if you wrote a book like Tallahassee Coates talking about a certain country. You can't even talk about a certain country. You can say there's genocide going on in the Sudan, but you better not say it's going on in this other country of land-grabbing thieves who are murderous. There's not free speech. What Trump is doing is saying he's going to find another reason to attack those who want to talk about things that are not in favor of white supremacy. And I wonder if you all have fought to get free speech in other ways, because we got a whole bunch of states, other courts and other things talking about certain types of free speech, which you can't have in the United States, whether it's against Biden or Trump or even in the past presidential race. One person allowed one group to talk and one person stopped the other group from talking. There's no free speech in the United States, and it's economic, and now it's going to be military and physical things against you. So I'm just wondering, did you go for free speech all the time, or are you just coming up for it now with somebody nobody even knows about? Because nobody in our community really has heard too much of Charlie Kirk, whoever he is, and we don't want to hear about a lack of remorse for his killing, but we want to hear about the lack of remorse for the killing of children in Palestine.
Okay, caller, you're breaking up. But I believe your question was just about the stances of free speech entirely and holistically in relation to our guests. And I'll let Cole go first and then Ed.
Certainly. Our country doesn't have a perfect history. I think that there's no question about that. We have gone through deep eras where speech and certain groups have been targeted. And also, we have a history of protecting political organizations, political organizing, and political speech. That might mean the Klan marching down the street of neighborhoods in the U.S. In deep displays of racism and anti-Semitism and so forth. And that has been protected speech. And what we see now is the government looking to sharpen their knife and strengthen their weapons that would allow them to designate protected speech as hate speech, which is a deeply un-American movement, and also to crack down on peaceful demonstration and organizing on the streets. Now, there are lots of ways that change has happened and can happen in this country, and nonviolent, peaceful organizing is one of those ways. And it should be concerning for all of us when the government is actively looking to find ways to crack down on that, to criminalize peaceful demonstration, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
You know, I'll just quickly add, thank you so much for your question. And you know, as the rights in our Constitution continue to be trampled on and attacked, the one thing that we do have is our voice, like this conversation today, like the callers bringing the topic up today, and that we just need to maintain as much courage as possible to speak out and not worry about as much as possible the consequences, or certainly not try to think, you know, if we don't say anything that's too offensive, then they won't come after us. Because in fact, we know that the more we cooperate, the more we capitulate, the more we are seen as weak, and the faster the attacks on our rights will be. And that we just need to keep lifting up our voices, whether it's through marches, through rallies, through shows like this, and not be afraid to call truth to power.
Thank you so much. I just want to thank my guests for joining me today, Mr. Ed Lazier, founder of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute, as well as Cole Lightyear, executive director of Americans Against Government Censorship. It was great to have you guys on to talk about this very pivotal moment in our country. Up next, we're going to be talking with Amy Austin, who is the CEO of the Washington, the Theater Washington. And we're going to be talking about Theater Week, which is an annual celebration of the DC area theater industry, produced by Theater Washington. So thank you again, Cole and Ed, for stopping by. And let's go ahead to our next guest, Ms. Amy Austin. Thank you for joining us, guys. So, Ms. Austin, thank you so much for coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself as well as Theater Washington in general?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me here. It was nice to listen into that last part of that conversation about our freedoms being threatened and what that means for all of us. But I'm here to talk about Theater Week. So I work with through Theater Washington. We work with all the theaters in the region, of which we count over 80. So Theater Week is a chance for us to talk and for people to see how wonderful, diverse, and exciting the theater community is here in the nation's capital. So we do a number of events. We just had a launch party last night for Theater Week. We're planning a concert and a season preview event. And we, all the theaters get together and have very specific pricing for all of their shows. So there's shows that Theater Week offers for $25, $45, and $65 for tickets to 25 plus shows that are happening between September 18th to October 6th. But the tickets are on sale right now, so they went on sale, so you can get them at theaterweek.org.
Okay, you broke up a little bit, but I just wanted to make sure you touched on the Theater Week is going to offer tickets for $25, $45, and $65 to over 25 shows, plus free events designed to showcase the depth and variety of theater within this region. And I believe they're in D.C., Northern Virginia, and Maryland. Can you talk about a little bit of the different plays and musicals that people would have access to?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the wonderful thing about Theater Week, that you can find shows of all different kinds, and we like to say that there's something for everyone, and we believe it. So you can go to theaters across the DMV. The theater are based in many neighborhoods across our area. So you could go see, there's a new musical that's just been rewritten, Damn Yankees, at Arena Stage. And that's full of a lot of local talent as well as some New York stars. I saw a really wonderful show at Gala Hispanic Theater, which is celebrating its 50th year in the Columbia Heights neighborhood. And they're doing Kiss of the Spider Woman, which is in Spanish with English subtitles. That's a gorgeous show with two brilliant Argentinian actors. There's a wonderful show about soccer and you know, growing up, that's at Only Theater Center, that is called Red Pitch. One of my favorites, Rorschach Theater, who does theater in found spaces. So they are in a space where they invent the theater. They put in the seats and put in the stage. They were in a Big Men's Tall Store last year, and now they're in a new space in the Navy Yard, and they're going to be opening So Late Into the Night. So I really encourage people just to go to theaterweek.org and take a look at all the productions that are available for these prices, $25, $45, or
I'm sorry. What are some signature events that you were bringing up that are around this particular event? I know that there is something called Light Up. Can you explain that?
Yes, it's a concert that we do at the Wharf. So the Wharf hosts us, and it's a free Theater Week concert where we sing songs that people are familiar with from musical theater in America, and also some numbers that you won't be familiar with. It's got a great all-star cast, and it's a free concert on Sunday, September 28th at 3 p.m. at the Wharf. It's on the Transit Pier, so it's a stage that they have that literally sits on the water, and it's a wonderful place to hear music. And then we also have a season preview coming up on Monday, September 29th. That's at Studio Theater. Well, we have a great panel that has art critics and dramaturgs and actors and directors and other people who are deep into the theater community and industry here, who are talking about what they're excited about coming up in the next season. So those are a couple of the events that we have happening. And there's more if you go to theaterweek.org, where you can get the free tickets for our events and also take a look at the shows.
That's wonderful. That's amazing. And can you just give our listeners some background into Theater Washington and how they have been intricate and interconnected into the theater and arts community within the area over the last several years?
Yes. Well, Theater Week has been going on for more than 7 years now, but Theater Washington has been part of the DC theater scene since the 1980s, in fact. So we do a number of programs, including Theater Week. So we work with, as I said, the professional theater community throughout the region. We do the Helen Hayes Awards. We do a Taking Care Fund, which is grants to people working in the industry. So we work a lot with the theaters and other partners through collaborative programming to raise the visibility of this amazing theater community that we have right in our backyard. And, just raise awareness that it's such a wonderful gift to be able to go into the theater, share storytelling, be together, see these incredible performances live in front of you. No night is like the next night because it's all live performance in the theater, and it is an experience like no other. So we're here to encourage people to go find a show and bring a friend and take that time to listen to some storytelling, hear some storytelling, and feel some storytelling from all these great organizations across the region.
I love the thought of go find a show and go bring a friend. That is amazing. That is super awesome. Any final thoughts, Ms. Amy Austin, CEO of the Theater Washington group within Washington? And I wanted to make the Washington, D.C. area. I wanted to make sure I was clear that this theater week is just basically like a restaurant week for theaters and those who love the arts and art lovers.
Yes, that's right, Jenna. It's modeled after Theater Week. It's the same way in which, it's modeled after Restaurant Week. It's the same way in which you go and discover restaurants during Restaurant Week. You go and discover theater during Theater Week. Many people go and see several shows during this time. And like I said, it is really great to bring a friend, a colleague, partner, husband, wife, and just be in the same space together and share these live performances. It will leave you feeling different than when you came in.
Thank you so much. Thank you for taking your time out today to just bring a lot of light and levity into this space, particularly in such a following such a heavy topic. That will do it for today's show. Thank you to Mike Nasala for all his engineering experience and expertise. And don't forget the blues with the amazing Lady Murr. I'm Jana Parker, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Can I Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back and is coming to Southeast DC for the first time ever. Enjoy 3 nights of martial arts and action films scored live with hip hop, soul, and more, mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two Tone Jones. Saturday, September 20th at Skyland Town Center with a screening of Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Gonna Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set, followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit shaolinjazz.com. shaolinjazz.com.
The United Black Community presents the 21st annual Love Supreme, a musical, poetic birthday tribute to Netaru, John Coltrane, featuring the NASA Aberdeen Quintet, Cindy Brown, Kenny Carroll, Nana Malaya, and more on Friday, September 19, 2025 at 7 p.m. at E-Life Restaurant, 9033 Central Avenue, Capitol Heights, Maryland. Details, UBC and DC at yahoo.com, 240-832-7203. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other, illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at WPFWFM.org, where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, is seeking a leader to serve as WPFW's next general manager. We are looking for someone with strong managerial skills, a commitment to independent media, an appreciation for African American culture and history, and a passion for community service. The general manager will guide WPFW's mission, oversee an extraordinary group of staff and volunteers, and help build the future of this listener-supported community treasure. If you are ready to lead with creativity, integrity, and vision, we want to hear from you. To apply or learn more, visit hr@pacifica.org.
What's it do if you're approached by the police?
We deserve to be safe in our neighborhoods.
Follow these tips to assert your rights.
If you're being stopped, detained, or arrested, the best thing to say is nothing.
Stick to only these questions. Am I free to go? If stopped by law enforcement, try to leave the conversation as quickly and safely as possible.
Ask, am I free to go?
If yes, walk away calmly.